Righteous loudmouth, I snarled down at him. This is no concern of yours. The hate was calling me. I had no time for further distractions, as satisfying as they might have been. I spat the taste of blood out of my mouth and turned back to Rudolph. He was on the ground, curled into a ball, gasping with pain, making choking sounds. He'd lost control of his bowels as well, and the stench made me want to tear his arms and legs off one at a time. But he wasn't alone. Waldo Butters had taken a knee beside him. The little knight faced me. He stood up slowly. I could see that he was shaking, trembling in every limb. His face was pale. The white cloak with its red cross was stained with blood and worse, dirty from the chaos it had been through. But it fit him.
Harry, he said, I can't let you. You saw what he did, I said.
My voice sounded like my throat was full of rubble and broken glass.
What he did to her. You have lost it, man, Butters said. His voice was pleading. Harry, I can't let you.
You'd protect that thing? I snarled.
He's not the one I'm trying to protect, he snapped back.
Something hard came into his eyes and the trembling vanished. He rose, the broken hilt of Fidelacius, the sword of faith, in his hands.
I'm trying to protect my friend.
Again, my clarity was broken. Again, I felt the rage surge through me. I didn't even bother with the words to a spell. Let it burn. I lifted my hand, and with it my rage, drew upon the wild power in the air, and ripped lightning out of nowhere and nothing, sending a thunderbolt at Rudolph with an incoherent scream of rage. Sudden, white light flared, blinding. The confines of the alley were filled with voices, louder than thunder, an angry chorus singing a warning note. From the broken hilt of the Sword of Faith came a blaze of light that intercepted that thunderbolt and sent it crashing into the wall above and behind Rudolph, which was a fine trick. But I knew the sword's secret. I wouldn't have to incapacitate Butters to get him out of the way. I strode forward, winding up with my left hand.
Harry,
Butters said, tears in his eyes.
Don't.
I lashed out, backhanded, striking at Butters' face. He held up the very non-physical sword in a parry, and my world became pain. There was no warning, no anything. The second my arm touched the plane of the blade of light, everything shifted. The power of the mantle wrapped around me vanished like mist before the morning sun. Every injury, every hurt, every ache and scratch and bruise and strain all came crashing onto me at once. I staggered, my limbs weak, as if I had suddenly gained several hundred pounds. I felt Rudolph. I felt his terror, his agony, his confusion, his humiliation, his remorse, his sick self-hatred. I felt them all as if they were my own. I saw myself through Rudolph's eyes, huge and vicious and deadly, implacable as an avalanche. And Murphy. Oh, God. Oh, God, Karen. My clarity withered before that light, before the star-bright blaze of pain in my left arm. I had to shield my eyes against the light of the sword with my right hand, though the mere movement caused me pain enough to threaten the contents of my stomach. The stench of my own charred flesh filled my nose, somehow laced with the scent of sulfur, brimstone. There was a blazon of blackened flesh along my left forearm, starting just above my shield bracelet and running to my elbow, straight as a ruler. I fell to my knees. I dropped to my right elbow, cradling the burned flesh against me. The scream of pure pain that came out of me wasn't loud. It was hardly human. And in its wake, I broke. I sobbed. while Sir Waldo, the Knight of Faith, stood over me with that blazing sword between me and Rudolph's curled, helpless form.
"I'm here, Harry," Butter said, his voice thick with tears. "Harry, I'm here."
The light dimmed and went out. I felt him crouch in front of me, felt his arms go around me.
"I'm here, man. I'm here." Oh, hell's bells. Oh, God. What had I done? I had almost, if not for Butters and Sonya, Murph would have been so ashamed, so terrified for me. Oh, God. Murph.
I leaned against him, sobbing, unable to control myself. Though he was only a little guy, he was wiry and tough. He didn't waver, not even when my whole weight leaned against him.
"He took her,"
I heard myself say, the words barely understandable.
"He took her from me."
Butters' arms tightened on me.
"He took her from all of us," he said. "And he'll answer for it before the law, Harry. But it can't happen like this. You can't let it happen like this."
He abruptly hauled me upright to face him. His expression was intent, hard, though tears ran down his cheeks.
"We need you. You, the good man. I can't let you hurt that man. Too many of us need him. Your daughter needs him."
It was that last phrase that did it. It hit me like a bucket of cold water. Maggie. Despite all the pain, despite the tears, my loss, I could see her there in my mind's eye. I could imagine her, awake in bed at Michael's place, as safe as anywhere in this town, but too wise to believe that everything was all right, holding on to Mouse and waiting in silence to understand events that were well beyond her ability to change. Oh, God. What had I almost done to her? Everything hurt. But there was enough left of me to feel shame. "I'm sorry," I said. "Butters, I'm sorry." His face twisted with empathy, and his tears fell harder.
"Sonya?"
I choked.
"I'm all right,"
I heard a groggy voice say from down the alley.
"Boja moi, you fight dirty."
I felt a large hand come down on my shoulder.
"Like a Russian."
"Sonya's here too. He'll be okay," Butters said.
I teetered forward abruptly, unable to stay upright. My friends caught me. They held me.
"I'm here, Harry," Butters kept saying. "I'm here."
"She's gone," I whispered.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"I know. I'm here."
And for a time, there was nothing else to be done. I wept, and the city burned. Chapter 24. Sonya and his people had gotten their act together pretty quick. They'd come in numbers, down three parallel streets, the one we'd been on and the street on either side of it. They'd gone with a simple tactic, advancing in a line and shooting anything that didn't look human with lots and lots of slugs and buckshot. Those largest huntsmen were a big job, but many hands make light work. The way Sonya told it, the first one to come roaring out of the haze had been scary, but he and his appointed uniformed officer had managed to stand and shoot, and enough of the volunteers had stood with them to bring it down before it could complete its charge. After that, after they saw with their own eyes that the enemy could bleed and die, things changed. The volunteers just stalked forward, killing huntsmen, whose spears, while terrifying and destructive, really went up to exchanging fire with pump-action guns while outnumbered 5 or 6 to 1. The enemy and creatures of winter alike gave way before that kind of pressure, much to their mutual dismay. The humans that those beings would normally consider their prey had opened their eyes, and armed themselves, and were willing to fight. For now, the volunteers outnumbered the foe, and the Fomor fell back, ceding the area to the scattergun brigade. I don't know how long I was out of the fight. Butters told me later it had only been a few minutes. All I know is that after a time, the physical pain began to recede, and I felt the winter mantle settle around me again. Sonya had broken my nose for me, I realized. Not that I hadn't earned considerably worse. Sobbing hysterically with a broken nose isn't real dignified, or practical for activities like breathing. It took me half a minute of coughing and spitting to get things cleared up. By the time I had, and it swiped at my eyes with a cleanish portion of my coat's sleeves, the burn of my broken nose and the aches and pains had once more faded beneath the staticky curtain of the winter mantle. Except for the burn on my arm. That one hurt, period. I'd dealt with burns before. This one wasn't the worst I'd ever gotten. Even so, it throbbed and pulsed and made me feel a little queasy and shaky. And it made me feel human. I'm not saying pain is what defines us as human beings, but it is, in many ways, what unites us. We all recognize other people in pain. Damn near all of us are moved to do something about it when we see it. It's our common enemy, though it isn't really an enemy. Pain is, at least when our bodies are working properly, a teacher. A really tough, really strict, and perfectly fair teacher. I didn't enjoy the steady, throbbing pain coming from the burn the holy sword had given me, but I did find it immensely reassuring. The pain on the inside of me was something else entirely. Carefully, I put that aside. I didn't try to bury it or freeze it. I just set it in a different room of my mental house and swung the door mostly shut. Later, there would be time to feel it. All of it. But I'd lost people before. That's the thing about being an orphan. Grief is a known quantity. Loss is your family. Sure, it was going to hurt. It was going to tear me up. The empty place where she had been would make me its bitch for a while. But that was for later. First, I was going to finish what we'd set out to do. Protect the city. And I was going to provide Murph with a fitting escort to what came after while I did it. Butters walked over to me with my staff. He passed it to me. I nodded at him. I didn't know where Rudolph was or what Butters and Sonya had done with him. I didn't want to know. Rudolph wasn't my problem. He couldn't be. I had too much responsibility to the city, to my friends, to my family. I slammed one end of my staff onto the asphalt and shoved myself back to my feet. I think someone was trying to talk to me on the way. I didn't listen, and without a word, I walked back to Murph's body. It really was so tiny. Now that she was gone, it seemed even smaller. I picked Murph up. She weighed almost nothing. I cradled her body against my chest and then walked, briskly, my arm throbbing, through the blocks back to Millennium Park, where Mab still waited behind her cohort, a warrior she. But instead of facing the oncoming threat, her gaze was waiting to find me as I emerged from the haze. She gave no visible signal, but the unicorn moved, nudging its way through the she as the queen of air and darkness rode out to face me. She regarded Murph's pale face, my bloody form, and said only,
"You have returned."
"Yes," I said. "She's a Jatun slayer. She deserves to be laid with dignity."
"And so she does," Mab agreed.
She turned and pointed a finger at one of the blocks of waiting she warriors. Half a dozen of them peeled off from the formation instantly, in unison, and marched over to us.
"See that this warrior is laid in state," she said, and moved her head in a curt gesture toward the bean. "She has shared our enemies and earned our respect, and so it shall be known amongst my vassals and to the farthest reaches of my kingdom."
The she saluted, fists to heart, their weird fey-metal armor ringing with tones like bells or wind chimes where it was struck. One of them offered up a long, narrow shield, and they took position on either side of it. She wasn't heavy. but I couldn't carry her and do what we'd set out to do. I put her down on the shield as gently as I could. I composed her as best I could. The gray, somehow shrunken remains weren't Murph, but they deserved more respect, more grace than I could offer. I put my hand on her head one more time, touched her hair one more time. Then I said, "Okay." As she carried Murphy's body, I went with them, enough to make sure they behaved. They did. Could be it was the bloodied, bruised, angry winter night standing over them that inspired it. Could be that it was real respect. The winter court and death are distant relatives. The only time I'd seen winter volunteer something like humanity was when someone had died. Maybe it was all they had left. My left arm throbbed and burned as they laid Murphy down atop a bier made of the cases the weapons had been stored in. The warrior she saluted the body, and then they filed out. It was only then I noticed that they were all female. I looked at Murphy's body lying on the crates. Except for all the blood and the gray skin, she might have been asleep. But she wasn't asleep. "I gotta go," I said quietly. I wasn't sure whom I was talking to. I suppose her death could have left a shade of some kind, but that wasn't it. It took a little time for a shade to condense. After I had briefly participated in it, the whole afterlife thing had become even more confusing to me, not less. "Ethnia is almost here. Mab's ready to make her play. I have to be there." One of her curls had fallen over her eye. I moved the curl back. It promptly fell over her eye again. I smiled through tears. Even dead, I couldn't make her do a damn thing. I leaned down and kissed her forehead. "I already miss you so much," I said quietly. "Goodbye, Murph." I rose to leave and almost bumped into Mab. She was standing so close behind me. I wavered and didn't. One does not bump into the Queen of Air and Darkness. It simply isn't done. Mab stared silently at the body for a breath, her eyes unreadable. Then she looked searchingly up at me. She was at her human disguise height, a little less than a foot shorter than me. The starlight in her hair was truly beautiful. Silently, she reached out and took my left arm. She pushed the sleeve of my duster up, despite my discomfort, and studied the burn for a moment. Then she said, with a slow, quiet, ever so slightly jealous tone, "That must hurt." "It does," I said. She closed her eyes for a moment and took a breath. When she opened them, it was all business again. "Can you fight?" "Watch me." "I shall," she said, "and you shall see something the world has not seen in many a year."
"What's that?"
"Mab at war," she said simply. She glanced to one side. "Your little ones have found King Korb. He has come ashore upon the beach east of here and joined Ethniu. It is time." She looked up at me. "When the moment is right, it must be you who calls out her name." I knew whom she was talking about. There was no need for explanation.
"Why me?"
"She will answer you," Mab said. "She has before." I exhaled.
"Oh, got it."
"Good." Mab touched my burned arm again and then withdrew her hand. "It is possible that I shall fall this night."
"You're immortal," I said.
"Immortal, not eternal. There is power here of the truly ancient world. It is enough to ensure the deed." She narrowed her eyes. "Should I fall, I have one last command you would be wise to fulfill." I tilted my head. "Kill Molly Carpenter," she said calmly, "as quickly as possible."
"Funny," I said. Mab stared at me. Of course, she hadn't been joking.
On a normal day, I would have been more upset. Today already hurt so much that I hardly noticed. Mab wanted me to kill someone. She usually did. It was sort of my job description. I frowned dully at her. Why?
As Winter Lady, she shows promise, Mab said. But she is not ready to become Mab. The consequences would be unsettling for both of you, perhaps for all of Winter.
I tried to think of the kind of situation that would unsettle Mab. My mind shied away from it. That's not going to be an issue, I said, because you aren't going to get killed tonight. When I bury Murph, she's going to be holding the shattered key to that titanic bitch's cell on Demon Reach in her hands. Mab's face blossomed into a carnivore's sharp grin.
Not the eye.
Fuck the eye, I said. She actually lifted her hand to cover her mouth, but I saw her eyes smile. It was damned eerie.
All upon the field tonight want that weapon. Your own White Council included. It is the primary reason they fight.
I blinked. I looked out at the ruddy haze outside and spat a curse. Of course. That's why everyone was fighting beside Mab. Not to honor the treaty, at least not for all of them, but to secure a weapon that would give them an enormous advantage over any of the other accorded nations. One that could be a threat even to immortals like Mab. I could imagine what the senior council would be saying about it if I accused them too.
Too dangerous, could cause havoc. Can't let those monsters have it. We'll be able to lock it away and keep it safe.
Should we be victorious, that will be the real fight, you know, Mab said. Her gaze, always penetrating, made me squirm. Who shall possess the eye?
Outside, said I, fill the night with light and destruction again. I heard the building fall this time, clearly. Hell. It was only a couple of blocks to the north. It might have been the one with Bradley's daycare in it. I can wreck buildings just fine all by myself, I said, and tapped the center of my forehead. And I got three eyes already. What the hell do I want with another big ugly one?
What indeed,
Mab said, as if I hadn't spoken. She closed her eyes and said,
I confess, it has been long since I have taken the field in earnest, my knight.
She showed me her teeth.
I think this shall be fun.
I blinked. Fun? Mab opened her eyes, and they twinkled, just twinkled. Then she turned in a wave of silken hair and starlight and strode out of the beam and onto the battlefield. Hell's bells, I muttered after her. I didn't hear it, of course, but my mind provided me with a perfect reproduction of Murph's dryly amused chuckle. I turned back to Murph's remains and touched her cheek with the backs of the fingers of my left hand, then paused. Her SIG, her favorite handgun, was still riding in its shoulder holster beneath her coat. Heroes are traditionally buried with their arms. But this fight was still going. I took the gun from its holster very gently. It wasn't a large weapon, but it fit my hand nicely enough as a backup. Backup, I said. You mind if I borrow her for a while? Murph couldn't say anything. But with a whisper where I'd moved it to get the gun, her coat fell open a little more, showing the spare magazines she had prepared. Thanks, Murph, I whispered. I took the magazines and backup. Then I stalked out to fight for the city. Chapter 25. I walked out of the bean and into the soundtrack of a B-horror movie. The Fomor forces didn't use drums to send signals in the haze. They used clicks. I suppose that made sense. Drums wouldn't sound like much underwater. But two rocks banged together are two rocks banged together. I just hoped that they weren't enough like dolphins to be able to see through the haze using the clicks too. I didn't think so,
since dolphins had an absolutely enormous biological investment in their natural sonar, but I'd had unpleasant surprises before. I strode through the ranks of the she cohort, and this time there were no games. They made a path for me with crisp precision. But I could sense their eagerness as I passed by. The Winter Court makes very little distinction between sex and violence. Their confrontation with me earlier had been foreplay, but now they were ready for the main event. Normally, before a big fight, I felt as intensely as they did, if differently, the adrenaline, the fear, the eagerness to get it over with. This time, I didn't. It wasn't that I didn't feel anything. I felt plenty. I just couldn't care too much about it, in the face of my loss. That was dangerous, both for me and for the people I was protecting. Battles are not graded on a curve, ever. You survive or you don't. And everyone you'll ever face in a battle to the death is undefeated. I had to get my head into the game. I strode across the park to the pavilion where Sonya and the volunteers waited. And as I went, the scarlet hazed air filled with eerie clicks that sounded hideously organic. They came echoing through the heavy air from multiple directions, north and south alike. The alphas fell in around me as I came to the volunteers, and Butters appeared from the haze to silently take up a position behind me and to my right where he could watch my back. Or stab me in it if I went all monstery, I supposed. Good.
Harry,
Sonya said cheerfully. One of the volunteers, damned if it wasn't Randy, was busy wrapping a bandage around the big Russian's head to secure the pad over his torn and bloodied ear.
You're just in time, da?
He gestured out at the unseen sources of the clicks.
What kind of monster do you think we get to kill now?
Doesn't matter, I said. If it bleeds, we can kill it, and they all bleed. Let's go.
Da,
Sonya said firmly, and raised his voice as Randy finished with the bandage.
All right, everyone. Offense, time for us to make them sorry. Defense, stay here and kill anything that comes from the north.
Sonya's chosen officers started calling out to their groups, and they began to spread out in a line facing east. The officers weren't being subtle about it. They physically shoved people into position. There were a lot of worried faces on that line. I could feel their fear. The kind that makes your limbs feel hollow and your forehead bead in a cold sweat. But through the banner, I could also feel their determination and the aggression radiating off that hideous unicorn that was seeping into them. They were terrified and furious, ready to spill blood. Sonya came up beside me. I'm sorry, I said. Sonya snorted. Thanks, I said. I lowered my voice. They're amateurs. If we run into enough trained professionals like Listen and his people, they're going to be slaughtered. Sonya gave me the side eye.
You think they do not know that?
He clapped a hand to my shoulder.
We all must die, Dresden. There's no shame in dying for something worthwhile.
I'd rather the Fomor died for something they thought was worthwhile, if it's all the same to you.
Ha, he said, grinning. Da, that is plan. And it is time.
I held up a hand sharply.
Wait.
Reports came in from the Malks through my banner. They were once again out ghosting through the haze. I tasted stagnant seawater on my tongue. There was so much of the scent in the air. Malks were not, on the whole, very bright. Too much of their brain was devoted to bloodshed. But my scout's estimates were not optimistic, and in some cases, almost fearful. Gray Malkin, I thought. I need an accurate assessment of enemy position and numbers. The elder Malk's reply came buzzing through my head in his creepy, creepy voice.
They are legion. Between 5,000 and 7,000. They march west through the park.
Holy crap. There was no way for about 800 amateurs with shotguns to fight that and win. Unless...
Damn it, I said. They're coming right at us. We have to beat them to Columbus. It's a double-wide separated roadway, and it's at ground level, maybe 15 feet lower than the park. There's a pedestrian bridge across. The bridge is higher than the park, and it will give them a firing position down onto her people, as well as an easy way across Columbus. Otherwise, they'll have to climb straight walls under heavy fire.
Destroy bridge? Sonya asked.
And hold the line for as long as we can. Do all the damage we can, I said. Sonya took a deep breath and then looked at the volunteers.
Nah, he said quietly. Then we must move quickly.
Yeah, I said. Then we jogged out in front of the volunteers and I called,
Follow me!
And we took off at a trot across the great lawn, our northern flank shielded by the defensive positions of the pavilion, with stealthy little monsters moving in a screen in front of us, serving as my eyes. What I had not considered was that 800 people running together make a thunder of their own. As we ran, I heard the alien clicking sounds stop and then resurge in a furious, faster tempo. Huh. They hadn't been expecting something like this. And now that I thought about it, I wouldn't want to run into 800 angry people with shotguns on an average Chicago evening either. The retaining wall on this side of Columbus came into sight, and I poured it on, aiming for the pedestrian bridge. Sonya started screaming orders to his officers, hard to hear over the sound of that many people moving. I didn't see the enemy team holding our end of the bridge through the haze until they popped up from under their cloaks like ghillie suits and opened fire. Angry wasps hissed through the air and someone hit me in the stomach with a baseball bat and drove the wind out of me. For a second, I couldn't tell what was happening. Some of my volunteers had raised their weapons and returned fire immediately, but most were confused. I knew the feeling. Getting shot at often confuses the hell out of me. And only training and experience allow you to respond with the kind of instant aggression necessary to counter that kind of surprise attack. I lifted my left arm, and only a lifetime of practice and dedication allowed me to bring up my shield through the pain. Pain? I looked down at my belly. There was no blood. I felt a hit on my shoulder, another on my cheekbone, even though nothing had touched my shield. And then I got it. My people were dying. I could feel it, feel their pain, their terror, their confusion. The air seethed with magical potential. I drew my blasting rod, gathered my will, dropped the shield, and screamed,
Fuego!
Because nothing cuts through bullshit like a proper fireball. The lance of energy that emerged from my blasting rod was an order of magnitude more potent than any I had thrown before, thanks to the cloud of terror over the city. The very air boiled and shrieked in protest, and when the blast hit the ground among the enemy fire team, the thermal bloom that erupted was a sphere of white-hot light. The concussion of that expanding heat slapped me in the chest so hard that it rocked me back a step. The enemy fire stopped. All that was left a few seconds later, as the fire boiled away, was a black circle on the ground, maybe 30 feet across, in a mound, where the heat had sucked the very earth up in a low, scorched dome. Some unrecognizable lumps and a small mushroom-shaped cloud of sullen red flame that vanished into black smoke. There was a second of stunned silence, and then one of the volunteers, damned if it wasn't Randy, shouted,
We've got a goddamn wizard! Fuck those guys!
The rest of the volunteers roared their defiance. I ran forward, and they followed. While we did, two of my people bled to death from their wounds. They just went out. One moment I could feel their terror and pain as if it were my own. The next, there was only silence. 1185. And I didn't even have time to find where they'd fallen and look at them. The footbridge isn't just a simple, straightforward bridge over an underpass. It's this enormous, gleaming serpentine thing that winds like a river, made out of concrete and gleaming, polished steel. It's solid, like really solid. And the only place it could reasonably be taken down was over Columbus itself, where it thinned out to normal bridge proportions. I drew up to a halt at the mouth of the bridge and turned to Sonya. Deploy our people in two ranks. One along the side of the bridge and the other along the wall over Columbus.
And you?
Those trees are blocking our line of fire. I gotta take them out, then go out on the bridge to take it down, I said. Be right back.
Not alone, Sonya said.
He isn't, Butters said firmly.
I eyed the little guy and didn't have time to argue. So instead I grunted, jerked my chin to indicate the direction, and started off. I couldn't get over how easy it was to use magic in the boiling air. I'd already performed several spells that by all rights should have left me in the need of a breather and a meal. Instead, the latent magic in the air made me feel exhilarated, eager to do more. Which isn't different from any other kind of power, I suppose. And it held the same dangers. So I was careful about how much force I used on the trees. Just enough to rip through each trunk and send them crashing down toward the street below. Once that was done, I raised my shield preemptively and hurried forward, following the curve of the bridge, even as some of the volunteers pounded out onto the bridge to take up firing positions overlooking the underpass. The enemy clicks became louder and more erratic, and I saw them for the first time as I stepped out onto the bridge. The Fomor army seemed to be organized in war bands. Each one had maybe 300 creatures in it, in a distinct group, gathered around a central standard. No two groups looked the same. Some were simply a collection of turtleneck handlers, each holding a pair of large, hairless, vaguely canine animals. Some were packs of shapeless, deformed things, naked, neither human nor animal. Their faces and bodies twisted and ugly, the cruelest combinations of expressed genes imaginable. Some were orderly ranks of armored warriors, their arms a little too long for their bodies, their shoulders too wide. Some looked like troops of more modern militaries and were armed with rifles. And at the center of each warband was a knot of Fomor proper, frog-faced jerks in badly clashing clothing, 7 feet tall. There were a couple of thousand of them, and those were only the ones I could see. The haze must have been concealing the rest. When I was spotted, things got a little crazy. Shots rang out and my shield lit up like a disco ball. Butters yelped and jumped behind me. I pressed forward. I had to get far enough up the bridge to bring it down. Someone shrieked something and one of the groups of those tormented abominations came howling toward me, their locomotion ragged and swift. Butters peeked out from behind me and said,
"Wow, red carrots everywhere."
I blinked and poured more energy into the shield. With this much available, it wasn't hard to hold it up.
What? What the hell do vegetables have to do with anything going on right now?
It's kind of a night thing.
I crouched low and got out of the worst of the fire. The walls on either side of the footbridge were about 5 feet high, and there was no way for them to get a clear line of sight to us. I felt clever as I hurried forward. And then I heard foont sounds. Grenades began to fall. Some of them went right on by and over. Trying to land a grenade inside the sheltered area of the footbridge was a damn tricky shot. But the enemy did what the enemy always does and showed up with more skill than they had any right to possess. I shoved Butters against one of the walls, pressed my lower back against his chest, and melded the shield's edges against the wall behind us. Half a dozen grenades went off in the space of maybe 15 seconds, and the world was just one enormous crunching sound after another. "Down," I growled as they stopped falling, and I lowered my shield. We dropped to hands and knees below the level of the bridge's walls, and I started crawling forward faster than I would have believed humanly possible. Butters followed. Evidently, they figured dozens of grenades had done the job, because we didn't take any more fire, until we rounded a corner and found ourselves face to face with 50 turtlenecks in full tactical gear.
"For Zare!"
I shouted and unleashed a broad stroke of pure kinetic force. I hit them harder than I'd meant to. The first three ranks of them went back like they'd been on wires and collided with the men behind them. The impact brought instant massive confusion.
"Butters!" I shouted. "Kill the bridge!"
And I charged, slamming my right hand forward, screaming,
"For Zare!"
with every stride, knocking the turtlenecks around like ninepins.
"Harry!"
Butters screamed.
"Kill the bridge, damn it!"
I shouted back. I heard the Sword of Faith come alight in his hands, and a glance over my shoulder showed him
hacking through the bridge at his feet as if it had been made of so many soap bubbles. I spun back to the enemy, brought my shield up, and stood tall.
"You," I said, relishing the moment, "shall not pass!"
They replied with a hail of automatic weapons fire. The impacts against my shield all but blinded me. And a freaking Fomor sorcerer popped out from behind a veil that had concealed him from me and lobbed a vicious-looking ball of quasi-liquid at me. I'd been burned once before, by assuming my shield would be ready to stop whatever came at me. I ducked and skittered forward and to one side, and the blob hit the bridge where I'd been standing. Whatever that stuff was, the xenomorph's blood had nothing on it. It started chewing at the concrete and the steel itself, bubbling and hissing as those substances were dissolved and a hideous stench filled the air. The Fomor smiled his froggy smile at me and tossed another to my other side. I dodged again, but I had less space to do it in. I did not want to walk into one of those puddles. Whatever that vitriol was, it would probably devour my feet in seconds. And then one of the turtlenecks lobbed a grenade high, aiming for it to come down behind my shield. A flicker of will and a muttered word, and I batted the grenade out of the air and back down among the turtlenecks. There was a fine amount of screaming and confusion as it went off, and I checked over my shoulder. Butters had hacked through the bridge, but the thing hadn't fallen yet. He dashed 20 feet back and started chopping again to drop that entire length out of the bridge. I held my shield and my ground as the turtlenecks recovered, way too swiftly to be acceptable, and poured it on again. The Fomor sorcerer had vanished. Those creeps didn't like to expose themselves to danger when they could whip their minions forward into it instead.
"Harry!"
Butters shouted. I started backpedaling, my shield bracelet beginning to overheat from use now, dribbling green-gold sparks everywhere. I made it back to Butters, and he slashed down with Phidolacius one final time before both of us rushed back around the curve of the bridge and out of line of sight with the turtlenecks. There was an enormous groaning sound, then a rumbling crash and a scream of ripping concrete and twisting metal. And now that we were out of the line of fire, the volunteers on the bridge started hammering away at the turtlenecks. Yeah, those guys were professionals, but they weren't bulletproof. I saw several go down before they started returning fire, and I felt phantom rounds hit my chest, my head. 1179. I fought not to throw up. There wouldn't have been much to come up anyway. The clicks rose to a sound like heavy canvas tearing, and the Fomor army came rushing forward in a storm of shrieks, wails, and screams. With the bridge out, their only option was to cross Columbus on foot, and they went bounding and leaping forward, jumping off the higher ground and down into the underpass without hesitation. And nothing happened.
"What?"
I demanded. "Where is Sonya?"
"Beats me,"
Butters said, panting. He was covered in concrete dust. The enemy massed on the far side of Columbus and then rushed forward toward us. They crossed the first traffic lane without being fired upon. They reached the median of the divided road, while more of their numbers piled into the underpass, a wave of flesh and steel and weaponry. They crossed the median in the first lane of traffic, and Sonya bellowed,
"No!"
800 men and women of Chicago popped up from behind the wall overlooking the sunken drive and opened fire with shotguns from a range of as little as 30 feet. The slaughter was indescribable. Shotguns are not precise weapons, but at 30 feet, and in the hands of an amateur, they don't have to be. The volunteers' fire swept the enemy's front ranks like a broom, killing and maiming without prejudice or mercy. The sound of it was a roar like I'd never heard before, with too many individual blasts to distinguish any one round going off, a deadly martial thunderstorm. The volunteers fired until their weapons ran empty, and if they'd killed fewer than 1,000 of the enemy, it was only by a couple. The enemy howled in their dismay and tried to run, but there was nowhere to go. Some tried to run up or down the street, but Sonya had positioned people all along the ground overlooking the sunken road, firing from defilade. and they enfiladed the ever-loving hell out of the Fomor army. Volunteers screamed their fury and defiance at the enemy. The volume of fire was so heavy that it magically turned a couple of stalled cars the enemy tried to take cover behind into Swiss cheese. Blood ran down the street in small rivers. The air grew thick with the iron stench of it. The enemy wasn't done. They took up positions of their own across the sunken road, behind just as much wall as my volunteers had. Then it became a gunfight. At that range, the professional weaponry of the turtlenecks wasn't substantially better than the volunteer shotguns. Arguably, the shotguns were a better weapon for a shooting gallery scenario, since they didn't need to be aimed as carefully or as long. But that only made it something like a fair fight. Men and women who had followed me died. I felt them dying. There were very few instant deaths. Even the people shot in the head had time to thrash and scream for a handful of seconds before the end. Some of them were so close I could hear them pleading for mercy. But death plays no favorites and makes no exceptions. 1114. Hell's bells, I muttered, shoving away the phantom sensory input to the best of my ability. I'd lost 73 volunteers, while the enemy dead numbered in the hundreds. We were winning. Granted, we weren't going to get any more effective surprise attacks. From here on out, we'd have to work for all of them. But we were doing it. We were holding them off. Until the Titan appeared. Ethnew strode out of the haze, 9 feet of terrible bronze beauty. She walked forward through the ranks, and while the enemy wilted and died all around her from my volunteer's fire, she herself was unscathed, as if she'd been walking through a gentle rain instead of a storm of slugs and buckshot. She stood observing our positions for a moment or two, utterly ignoring everything the volunteers tried to do to her. Jesus, I said, realizing her intent.
Butters, get them off the bridge!
I took off, screaming for the volunteers to follow me. I ran back until the bridge met the park on our side of Columbus, then hopped up over the sidewall and slid down the shining steel slope on the other side to the ground. Then I ran toward Sonya. He had seen what was happening, too. He was screaming for a retreat, but over the roar of gunfire, no one could hear him. Then Ethnew turned the eye upon our side of the street. The world went red and howling. She simply tracked the eye up and down the retaining wall, blasting it into a slope of finely ground rubble. Some of my people saw it coming in time and ran. Most didn't. They died. They died badly, consumed in a fire made from the raw, seething hatred of a Titan. Whatever pain they feared most, they felt as they died. Images of despair and doom flashed in that fire, and so much fear that many of my people went mad in the partial second of suffering they had left before their bodies were broiled and blasted to dust. And I felt it with them. 732. It hurt so much I couldn't breathe. In the space of a long breath, Ethnew had wiped out more than half of the offensive component of my little army. Winning. What a joke. Mortals could not stand against that. The Titan lifted her hand, a gesture elegant, and pointed forward with one finger. And with a roar, the Fomor army surged forward, down into the sunken road. A wall on our side of Columbus had been blasted into a slope, one the enemy would have no trouble climbing en masse. If we stayed, we'd be swallowed up in moments, and the enemy came at us eagerly, scenting victory, literally baying for our blood.
Retreat!
I screamed.
Retreat!
Most of the volunteers were way ahead of me. But many, 87 in fact, had been injured and could not run. They went down fighting. 645. The rest of us ran for our lives. Chapter 26.
It isn't a very long run from the bottom of the bridge to the pavilion. It's maybe a couple of hundred yards. That distance feels a hell of a lot longer when there's an army chasing you. Without the pall of smoke and dust, their shooters would have gunned us down. It was bad enough for a while anyway. The enemy soldiers on the far side of Columbus fired furiously into the haze. They couldn't see us once we were maybe 10 feet back from our side of the street, but there wasn't anything to stop the bullets from coming, either. I felt phantom wounds tear into me as more of my people were hurt by pure, merciless statistics. I threw up my shield as wide as I could and turned to face the enemy while walking backwards.
"Get behind me!"
I shouted. Some did, a little knot of defenders gathering around Butters and Sonya. The Alphas came hurtling out of the haze, muzzles bloodied, and also crouched down in the shelter of my shield. Both groups huddled behind me, and I kept my steps slow and steady so that they could match my pace. The volunteers reloaded their weapons in the safety my shield offered.
"How long can you hold it, Harry?"
Butters asked.
"Won't have to be long," I shouted back. "They'll stop shooting as soon as..."
The enemy fire abruptly stopped.
"Their vanguard gets to the other side of the street and obstructs their fire,"
I shouted into the sudden quiet. I dropped a shield.
"Hell's bells, move!"
We ran. Every single volunteer who had followed my banner was willing, but not all of them were terribly able. The folks who had gathered around Butters and Sonya were almost all older citizens who weren't going to be winning any marathons anytime soon. I'll give them credit, though. They still held their weapons, as if they meant business.
"Weapon!"
I snarled at one of the more weary-looking men, and he passed me his shotgun.
"Keep going. Head for the pavilion."
I dropped back to the rear of the group and found Sonya, Butters, and the Alphas already there ahead of me. I passed the shotgun to Butters, who reduced the Sword of Faith to a wooden handle again, stowed it, and checked the firearm with, if not professionalism, at least confidence. Without a word, I traded looks with Sonya, and then the three of us spread out and turned to scuttle along backwards, Sonya and Butters with their weapons raised, me holding up the glowing tip of my blasting rod. The Alphas, meanwhile, darted out to our flanks, their furry forms vanishing swiftly into the haze. The first shapes to emerge from the haze were those hairless canine things, of course, running across the ground at a low rush.
"Get some!"
I shouted and raised my blasting rod.
"Fuego!"
Butters' shotgun bellowed and Sonya's Kalashnikov hammered away at a metronome's pace. Creatures snarled and screamed and fell. Fire bloomed among them, sending dozens running and screaming with their injuries. Our pursuers, though clearly still desperate to reach us, juked back and forth, both exposing their fellows to the fire and slowing the entire mass of them, until we could see the shapes of those broad-shouldered, long-armed, armored figures approaching behind them. We had discouraged their advance, but we couldn't stop it. We kept going backwards, and the enemy kept getting closer. I applied my blasting rod without slowing down, hurling one blast of green-gold fire after another, sending some of my foes screaming with dread and pain while others took their place and closed the distance between us.
"That's it!"
bellowed Sonya somewhere just a bit behind me.
"Dresden, down!"
I heard Butters yell. Something got behind my knees and I tumbled onto the grass.
"Fire!"
Sonya bellowed, and a thunderstorm erupted in the air around me. I lay there gasping for breath and instinctively raised my arms to shield my head. I saw Butters, who had hit me in the knees in a friendly tackle, lying as flat as he could and doing the same. I realized that we had backpedaled all the way to the fortifications the Svartals had prepared. Maybe a quarter of the defenders left behind at the fortifications had come to our aid. A hurricane of buckshot swept the field. It wreaked havoc among the charging canines and sent them scurrying. One or two of the armored figures dropped, but the others retreated in good order, dragging the wounded with them.
"Cease fire!"
Sonya yelled.
"Cease fire!"
The fire trailed off as people emptied their guns, mostly, but it ended, and the survivors managed to clamber into the fortifications all the same.
"Contact!"
screamed someone from the other side of the fortifications.
"Fire!" Shotguns roared. The spears of the huntsmen shrieked.
Sonya!
I shouted.
On it!
The Russian called back. He vaulted past me into the fortifications and headed for the north side to take command of the defense there.
Find a firing position, I shouted to the rest of the defenders. Reload!
Butters and I got up and hurried inside, where probably too many of the defenders were trying to figure out what had happened to the mobile force. They were gathered around Randy, who was on his knees, sobbing.
They're dead. They're all dead.
Butters, I said.
Yeah,
Butters said. He went to Randy's side, put an arm around the man, and started speaking quietly. I looked up to find all the people who had followed me staring down at me. From their expressions, they didn't want it to be true. It's true, I said in a firm, steady voice. The enemy hit us hard, and they bled to do it. There's 1,000 dead bad guys lying on Columbus right now, and the rest of them have to climb over the corpses of their buddies to come forward. I looked up and down at the people watching me. I've got no claim on you, I said. If you want to run, I can't stop you. But by now, the enemy is pressing us from 3 sides, maybe 4. It might still be possible to retreat if you leave here and go straight west. If you want to do that, go for it. But if you borrowed a gun and ammo, leave them here. The people who are going to fight will need them. Because if we don't stop them here, nothing is going to stand between them and the rest of the town. On the far side of the pavilion, fire rose into a thunder and died away again to occasional barks of weapons discharge. The enemy's first rush at the fortifications must have failed. You came here to fight. So did they. If you've got loved ones somewhere behind us, you've got a reason to stay. If you don't, the weapon that just killed most of the mobile force is going to be used on them. Make up your mind. Now. There was a long silence while everyone stared at me. I turned and hunkered down by Randy across from Butters.
We can't fight that, Randy sobbed. No one can.
I put my hand on his shoulder. The skinny man looked up at me through tears. He wasn't a coward. He just hadn't been ready for what he'd been forced to see.
No one can fight that, he whispered.
I made a dangerous moment's eye contact and said hard, I can. I stood up and offered Randy my hand. But I can't do it alone. I need your help. He stared at my hand. The volunteers stared at us. I could feel the moment hanging in the air, brittle and tense as crystal. They were terrified. The survivors of the earlier action were terrified, and the defenders were terrified. And all of them were watching Randy for his reaction. The man closed his eyes for a moment. Then he whispered,
My little girl was born early yesterday. She's still in the hospital. They couldn't move her.
Well, I said, that makes it pretty simple. But that's not the same thing as easy, is it? His jaw clenched. And when he looked up at me, his eyes were hard and cold. No, it sure as hell isn't. The sound of his hand smacking into mine was loud in the hazy quiet. Butters and I pulled Randy to his feet. Something like a long exhalation went through the volunteers. They turned back to their positions, watching the ruddy haze for any incoming enemy.
Sir Knight,
came Gray Malkin's creepy voice.
I report.
Officers, I called. Get them into firing positions and make sure everyone has enough ammo. If you don't, there are cases of the stuff. Assign a runner to bring more.
Then I turned and walked several paces away, muttering, Go, Gray Malkin, report.
I am near the enemy,
the elder Malk said.
Hear them for yourself.
And suddenly my senses surged and I was elsewhere.
A ridiculous mess, hissed King Korb's voice. You said there were no mortal forces on the field.
A steady baritone answered.
And there weren't. This one came from nowhere.
Nowhere,
snarled Korb, furious. His voice bubbled like a teapot.
Would you like to see what nowhere truly looks like, slave?
I looked around me. I was crouched in a hollow space beneath a mound of rubble, my fur compressed on all sides. And the ground was hard and vicious against my paws. The air was full of the scent of blood, human and monstrous alike, and the smell made me flex my claws in and out repeatedly in instinctive reaction. Ah, I was getting Gray Malkin's sensory input then. Ethnew spoke, and the Titan's voice was thoughtful, rich, vibrating pleasantly through octaves of sound I could not possibly have heard with human ears.
Korb, she said, cease your whining. Listen has proven his ability repeatedly.
Yet he could not see a small army of mortals ready to bleed us dry.
Listen spoke, his voice steady.
It is hardly reasonable to expect millions of people to lie down and die for our convenience, especially not in a place with so many interests in the supernatural world. We knew they would fight. The battle plan proceeds smoothly enough.
Smooth?
Korb spat.
A fifth of my legion fills the gutters with their blood.
They shouldn't have advanced without hearing from my recon team.
Your team was dead,
the Fomor King shrieked. Listen replied without passion or uncertainty.
Which should have been an excellent indicator that it was not safe to attempt the crossing.
The air suddenly crackled with sorcerous power.
Korb, Ethnew said. Put your hands down or I will rip them off.
Korb burbled a curse in some language that sounded absolutely disgusting.
Better, Ethnew said. Captain, listen. The enemy is in fortified earthworks around the pavilion, Listen said. And even if we had sufficient squids remaining, we couldn't use them here. The Svartalves appear to have prepared the lattices over the pavilion to prevent them.
They had? Hell's bells, I hadn't noticed that. And I'd been standing in the place. Granted, I'd been a little distracted, but how the hell was Listen smart enough to know that?
Mab appears to have taken position here, in front of the cloud gate, Listen continued. She has a single cohort with her.
Even the battle cohort of the Shi is no match for us,
Korb said.
Attack!
Ethnew's voice was acidic.
Naturally. Mab will be an easy kill, I am certain. Listen. We have no intelligence of One Eye taking a position on the battlefield, Listen said calmly. This is obviously a trap.
Damn it. I mean, he wasn't wrong, but...
Of course it's a trap, Ethnew said. That woman is a spider. The question is why she's allowing us to see it so easily.
The surprise attack took her off her guard,
Korb said.
The bodies of better than 500 mortal troops we never knew existed would suggest otherwise, Listen noted.
Those were not soldiers, spat Korb. That was merely an armed rabble.
An armed rabble that killed a fifth of your legion? Ethnew asked. Perhaps I chose my ally poorly.
Korb made a sputtering sound, but didn't speak, which showed he had at least a few brains.
The ambush was well set, Listen said. Partisans always fight that way, strike and flee. It is necessary given their lack of training and discipline.
We must pin them down, Ethnew said.
And we have, Listen replied. They are trapped inside their own defenses. My people and the huntsmen press them from the north and have circled behind them in the west. They will not have another opportunity to inflict such damage. We only have to hold steady and finish pushing the blade home.
Your recommendation, Captain?
Destroy their fortifications with the eye, Listen said promptly. Assign a cohort to mop them up after, then turn everything upon Mab.
Ethnew was silent for a time before she said,
Mab is too close. Should I use the eye upon those fortifications, it will give her a window of opportunity in which to strike.
Aha. Uh-huh.
The super weapon wasn't a wonder weapon. It had some kind of cooldown period. Good to know.
Bring some heavy weapons teams and bombard the fortifications, Listen said. It won't be as decisive, but they're only earthworks.
Will it be done before the mortals arrive with their mechanical weapons?
Difficult to say, Listen said. You saw who was leading the rabble.
The Winter Knight,
Corp spat. He is canny, resourceful, and stubborn, Listen said. It could be that he wields enough power over them to keep them in place and fighting for a time, despite the bombardment.
Stupid Jotnar, Corb muttered, dying to mere mortals. Were they here, they could simply stomp the fort flat.
They died killing the Einherjarin, Listen noted. Frankly, given what the Revenants can do, I regard the trade as one in our favor. And we have a second group of Jotnar in the south. Could they be summoned?
Our messengers keep getting swarmed by these thrice-damned little folk,
Korb spat.
Who knew they were here in such numbers?
I did, Listen said in a flat voice, and my reports from the various scouting missions mentioned it specifically.
Mind your tongue, you jumped-up bed boy,
the Fomor snarled.
Enough, Ethneu said in a tone that made me clench up a little. When she spoke again, it was in her usual voice. Captain, Listen. The fortress is yours. Suppress it until such time as Korb and I have destroyed Mab. Once she is no more, I will reduce the fortress.
We attack,
Korb said, his tone enormously self-satisfied. Unwise, Listen said.
Time flees from us, Ethneu replied. Risks must be taken. I need someone competent on the fortress.
What?
Korb said. She said she needed someone competent, Listen replied in a polite, helpful voice.
Prepare your warbands, King Korb, Ethneu said in a placating tone. We will destroy Mab together, and your people will have their vengeance upon the Shi.
Korb made a sound that would have been more appropriate coming from a tea kettle.
Then he stalked away, followed by a retinue of Fomor as his personal bodyguards.
He will kill you in your sleep one night, Ethneu predicted.
I'll be waiting for him, Listen replied.
For a mortal, you are uncommonly capable and insouciant, Ethneu said. If I did not need you for later, I might kill you myself.
But you do need me, Listen said calmly. And you haven't got anyone else as good as me.
I find it pleasant to have the service of someone who can think, the Titan replied. Yet you are mortal.
One is much like another. How many Starborn are there wandering about this close to the end? Listen's voice broke off abruptly. Sergeant, I want a light on that mound of rubble right now. The world blurred as Grey Malkin moved, and gunfire roared painfully, loud and near. Gunfire crackled out in the haze somewhere, and I staggered and nearly fell as I found myself back in my own body fully once more. Grey Malkin, I thought.
Not now, Knight,
came the pained and furious reply. Mab, I thought experimentally.
I heard, my Knight, came Mab's voice, throbbing in the vaults of my mind. It would be ideal if you were in position behind Ethneu when the time comes.
I ground my teeth. You don't ask for much, do you?
Whinging does not become the Winter Knight, Mab said.
Listen, and his people will wipe my volunteers out if I leave them. Mab's mental hiss was painful.
They will also die if Ethneu is not defeated along with your city. There is no time for arguments. Choose.
Damn it. Mab's logic was cold and inhuman, and it wasn't wrong.
Get me, Sonya, I snarled.
The Russian showed up a minute later.
Professionals are coming, I said. Bad guys.
Sonya couldn't really blanch very well, but I saw him swallow.
Boy, jamoy.
Good news is they're pretty conventional, I said.
Bad news is that it's Listen running them. He's smart. Smart enough to have been running various operations for the Fomor in Chicago for freaking years, as a front for scouting the place out for tonight. Sonya lowered his voice.
I cannot hold this place with these people, not for long.
Hopefully you won't have to, I said. You don't need to fight so much as survive for a while. My head snapped back as a sledgehammer swung by someone on a speeding train hit me right in the middle of my forehead. I staggered. One of my volunteers fell from his position. Pretty much all that was left of his head was his mouth and jaw.
Down!
Sonya screamed.
Heads down!
Then we heard a number of hollow booms, and a second later, a chorus of whistling sounds.
Mortars! Sonya snarled. Incoming! Everyone down! Butters!
I shouted. I took off at a sprint and felt Butters on my heels. The little guy could really move. The training he'd been doing with the carpenters was serving him well tonight. I whipped up as much of a veil as I could around us as we ran. It wasn't going to keep anyone from seeing that something was moving, but as long as we kept moving, it should make it a lot harder to shoot us. We dashed out of the pavilion as the mortar shells began to fall among the fortifications, and my people began to scream and die behind us.
Chapter 27. The Svartalfs had built the earthworks around the pavilion proper, the auditorium, and concert hall. The great lawn had been stripped down to bare earth and styrofoam packing in the process. Running across the broken earth was easy enough, except for all the bullets, and since the sidewalks around it had been made to be even with the lawn at its usual level, it meant that we had to hop up about 3.5 feet onto the sidewalks to get back up to the park's ground level. We got lucky with the bullets, or at least we didn't get unlucky. The shimmering field of the veil around us made us look like blurs in the air, maybe a little bit more obvious than a predator. Between the veil and the pall of smoke and dust, trying to actually aim at any specific point on our bodies was hopeless. And the dimly seen enemy was mainly focused on dropping mortar shells on the earthworks. They couldn't get enough guns pointed at us to simply fill the air with lead, not in the few seconds we were in the open and running, though the weight of the enemy fire increased with every step. I hit the ground with my staff and vaulted up to the ground level of the park, sliding on concrete for a few yards before springing up and continuing. Butters just jumped, hit the edge of the sidewalk at about belt level, and scrambled up with the agility of someone with a higher power-to-mass ratio than his build would suggest. We sprinted forward through the trees and onto the concrete in the square around the beam.
Friendlies!
I shouted into the haze as the vague forms of the winter cohort resolved themselves into the shapes of the ranks of the armored she. The entire formation snapped into battle posture, shields rising, knees bending, weapons lifted when we appeared, and it did not relax from it as we approached. I dropped the veil as we did and slowed my pace to a swift walk as I reached the ranks and plunged through, sword tips just barely moving out of my way. Stay close and keep mum, I muttered to Butters over my shoulder. Especially with Mab. Don't get caught making anything that could sound like a promise.
Don't accept anything that could be construed as a gift.
That include advice? Butters asked. I glowered at him. He grinned at me, and then his face suddenly went slack as we emerged from the troops, and he faced the Queen of Air and Darkness on her winter unicorn.
Well done, my knight, Mab said to me without preamble. You wounded them enough to plant the seeds of doubt.
Mortar shells continued to fall on the pavilion. Occasionally small bits of dirt and debris would plunge down from overhead, pinging off the she armor or clattering against the concrete. My skin felt as if someone had slapped it with a large grid of barbed wire and then dragged it several inches. The earthen fortress was down to 622 defenders, with more than 200 of them wounded, and I could feel each and every scratch. I buried the sensation behind a wall of pure mental discipline, hard earned over my entire lifetime. But I was feeling grouchy, I assure you.
Oh, good, doubt seeds, I said,
If we water them and wait and eat all our vegetables, maybe they'll grow into doubt saplings.
Do not be ridiculous, Mab said. Her lips peeled slowly back from her teeth. They grow into fear.
Which makes them angry, I said. Fear always becomes anger.
Precisely, Mab said. An angry foe is predictable, easily manipulated.
Well, you've manipulated Korb and Ethneu into coming right at you, I said. A chorus of chirping clicks erupted from the far side of the park and began to grow steadily louder. Mab cast a gaze across the field that on most females would have been reserved for their lovers.
Yes. Korb will whip his people into a frenzy. They will charge us, howling for blood, blind to anything but our deaths.
I eyed her and said, Oh, good. Mab glanced at me and said,
Do not be afraid of Korb, my knight.
He and his were destined to be sacrificed from the moment Ethneu conceived of this plan. I know the Shi are dangerous, I said, but there's not enough of them, not for what is coming at us. The clicking grew louder. The Queen of Air and Darkness cast back her head, her eyes going wild, her smile widening to inhuman proportions.
The numbers stand at one Mab to none. That advantage shall be sufficient.
Suddenly, I was aware of the creatures of winter beneath my command, racing to join us. The temperature around us abruptly plummeted. White winter frost began to crackle across the face of the bean, and Mab shuddered and arched her back, her eyes closing as the breath of winter itself gathered around us. White mist began to thicken the gray haze of the city. The air suddenly became close, intimate, as the cloud of cold vapor enveloped the cohort. The fey metal weapons of the Shi began to creak and moan as deathly frost formed upon them. And I realized that I could suddenly see no farther than maybe 15 feet tops.
We won't be able to see them coming, I said in a low voice.
Irrelevant, Mab replied.
In the shadows of the bean behind us gathered the Malks and Black Dogs, the Rake and the Ogre, the Gnomes, and double dozens of the viciously mischievous little folk of winter. Before us, the Shi abruptly began to chant and sing, gesturing with their hands as they did. Flickers of light glittered over the cohort in a dome. Shapes and sigils, runes and formulae crackled briefly in the air, as 200 sorcerers gathered their power from the hyper-energetic air.
What the hell?
I held up my staff, opening the channels to the energy storage structures inside, and drew that energy down into it. The task normally took an hour of intense concentration and exhausting effort when I had to provide the energy for the staff myself. With the air gone mad with power, the staff charged in seconds, which should not have been possible, not without the excess energy overflowing into waste heat and burning the thing to a crisp. Instead, it simply let out a low hum, the runes carved into glowing green gold and the faint, excellent